There's apparently a chap called Alexander Woolcott who first gave voice to a classic complaint of bored 20th century man. He said, all the things I really like to do are either immoral, illegal, or fattening. Well, I don't know about fattening. The law of the Lord does have something to say about diet, but mercifully it's not included in chapters 19 to 24 of Exodus. I do, however, want us to think this morning about those first two of Woolcott's pejoratives, immoral and illegal. What do you think the relationship ought to be between those two adjectives? If you were to put that question to people, say, 500 years ago, they'd have felt the connection between immoral and illegal ought to be very close indeed. In those days, people believed in the universality of moral values. The difference between right and wrong, they said, was built into the nature of things. They even talked about natural law. And so it was the job, they felt, of the civil law, the law of the land, to reflect and enforce that instinctual sense of justice, which they said is common to all right-thinking and civilized people. In an ideal world, what was immoral and what was illegal would be very closely related indeed, perhaps even identical. But in the last 100 years or so, a dramatic change has taken place in people's thinking about this. In fact, there's been a deliberate attempt to sever the connection between legality and morality, to put these two words really in two completely different boxes. The main reason this has happened is quite simple. People have lost confidence in that natural law, that universal morality. Scientists have come along and told us, well, we're just chemical machines, our responses to our environment are purely mechanical in origin, behavior is just the product of electrons buzzing around in our brains on predetermined paths. There's no ought about life. We're determined by the same scientific laws as the rest of the physical universe. Zoologists have come along and said, yes, behavior can be interpreted in terms of animal responses, aggression and sex drive and social cooperation and territory defense and the like. Oh, yeah, we put moral labels on these instinctive behavior patterns because of our heightened sense of self-consciousness as human beings. But under this smokescreen of ethical rationalization, we zoologists can see the old naked ape struggling like every other animal to survive. And then, perhaps most recently, the social psychologists have come along, picking up the story. Oh, we can show that moral values are just conditioned by social requirements. We feel that certain things ought to be because we've grown up in a society that's taught us to feel that moral response. But if we'd been brought up among the Melanesian frog worshippers, then we'd feel completely differently about it. And then finally, the philosopher has put in his two pennyworth of moral doubt. Well, according, of course, to our modern methods of logical analysis, statements about morality can't be verified by any reliable philosophical criteria. They're statements of emotion, not statements of fact. And it's not hard to see, when all these intelligent people speak with such authority, why people generally feel that moral law, as a binding directive upon people's decision-making, is no longer believable. If that little voice inside us that says, well, this is what people ought to do, is really just an electron impinging on some neuron in my brain, or some rationalization of animal instinct, or some echo of my social conditioning, or some emotional reaction indistinguishable from my preference for Beethoven, well, then why do I really need to take any notice of it? This sense of obligation, I feel, is surely illusory. It's an artifact of my mind, or at least of society's collective mind. A convenient myth in the days of our evolutionary infancy, but now superseded, now we understand ourselves more scientifically. So the view has grown in the last couple of 100 years that morality doesn't adhere in the eternal nature of things at all. Morals are things we human beings invent, mere social expedients. And that being so, of course, there is no natural law upon which jurists can base civil legislation for the society that they belong to. Law of the land, they say, is simply the law of the land. That's all there is to it. Just as you need rules to play a football match, so you need rules to organize society. But if society wants to stop playing football and start playing rugby instead, there's nothing to say it shouldn't. No natural law imposed from above that says what its laws must be. It's up to the government to decide. The law is simply a tool by means of which governments adapt to changing sociological circumstances and pursue their own political and economic and social goals. It's government statutes that determine what's legal and what isn't. Morality is so changeable and subjective it can have nothing to do with it. And so you see the words illegal and immoral, which used to be very closely related, have been separated into practically non-overlapping zones of meaning. The one having reference to the courts, the other having reference only to the conscience. Well, now this morning, in our study together, I've got one very simple aim, and that is to challenge that whole contemporary mode of thought. I want to suggest to you that the old way of thinking, which saw a close relationship between what is legal and what is moral, was right all along. And that this modern trend towards so-called positive law, as jurists call it, it's altogether misguided. And I say that not just because I'm one of these reactionary conservatives, you know, who longs for the good old days. The reason I want to suggest that to you this morning is because it seems to me our Bible study passage demands, argues clearly for such a view of law. If you look through chapters 20 to 23 of Exodus, you'll discover that what they are is really the legal system of ancient Israel, the kernel of its legislation. Laws about everything, from accidental damage and lost property to first-degree murder and grand larceny. And if you're interested in the details of these legal provisions, then you will find quite a lot of material about them in the studies we did on the Ten Commandments just a few years back. They're available in the tape library. You can buy them or hire them out. I don't intend this morning to attempt to repeat that kind of close examination of every verse in these passages, even if we could find the time to do it. Instead, what I want to do this morning is to draw our attention to a single fundamental principle which underlies all these chapters, flows through the whole system of God's law on Mount Sinai, and which seems to me of vital relevance to this whole question of judicial legislation in our day. And that principle, that fundamental, is simply this, that in the polity of ancient Israel, the law of the land quite clearly rested consciously upon a foundation of God-given moral imperatives. If a thing was illegal in ancient Israel, it was so fundamentally because it was also considered immoral. That is, contrary to the law of God. If you examine these chapters carefully, you'll discover that, in fact, these statutes are cast in two quite distinctive modes. And these two modes clearly bring this point I'm trying to make to your attention. See, on the one hand, there are what scholars call casuistic laws. You'll find an abundance of those in chapters 21 and 22. Their hallmark is that they almost always begin with the word if. The first verse of chapter 22 is a good example. If a man steals an ox or a sheep, it says. Now, this form of law is fairly obviously directed at the judges who are responsible to administer justice in Israel. It's telling them what to do in specific cases of misdemeanor or dispute, and it's laying down the penalty for the crime or the legal remedy for the situation. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he must pay back 5 head of cattle for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. The legislation comprises then what we would normally call civil law. Statutes passed by our Houses of Parliament tend to be more verbose and complicated, but of the same basic form. And there are plenty of examples of this kind of casuistic laws, it's called, in other legal codes of that period. What I want you to notice, though, is that alongside this civil law format that begins with the word if, we find a second kind of legal formulation, one which actually is much rarer in the ancient world, what scholars call technically apodictic law. Now, the classic example of that is the Ten Commandments themselves. But if you look carefully, you'll find more examples in the latter part of chapter 22 and the first 19 verses of chapter 23. The characteristic thing about this apodictic form is that it's always expressed in the imperative. There's no conditional form, no word if, just a simple second-person imperative, often negative in form. You shall not murder. You shall not steal. Or in chapter 23, verse 1, do not spread false reports. Or in chapter 23, verse 8, do not accept a bribe. Notice, unlike the casuistic law, there's no mention of any specific civil penalties that a judge might need in order to enforce the law. Instead, quite often, there's some kind of exhortation or explanation added as an incentive to obedience. On occasions, the law even seems to preach a mini-sermon to its hearers, like it does in chapter 20, verse 12, honour your father and mother, so you may live long in the land your God is giving you. Or in chapter 23, verse 9, don't oppress an alien. You yourselves know how it feels to be aliens because you were aliens in Egypt. Now clearly these commands are not being directed at the court. These apodictic laws in the imperative are being directed at the consciences of individual citizens. They represent, in other words, what we would call moral law. And the fascinating thing about the legislation of Moses is that this apodictic moral law and the casuistic civil law are interwoven, if not inextricably, at least in a manner which shows quite clearly that the two things were intimately related in the mind of God. In fact, a careful study reveals that the latter, the civil law, is just a development from the former, the moral law. The civil law rested on the moral imperative. Take the legislation about protection of life, just as an example. The moral law was satisfied with a short, sharp statement, "You shall not murder," for it's addressing itself to man's conscience. Once we get into the civil law courts and deal with the casuistic forms of the law, well, actual cases cause complications. What if the killing was unpremeditated or accidental? Surely that should be different. What about death through negligence or killing in self-defense? Well, if you look through verses 12 to 14 of chapter 21, or verses 28 and 29 of chapter 21, or chapter 22, verse 2, you'll see that there are casuistic laws developing that moral imperative, you shall not murder, for different kinds of unlawful killing. It's the beginning of a complex legislation on homicide and manslaughter, just as we have it today. But its root, you see, lies in that moral commandment with all the authority of God behind it, you shall not murder. Same goes for the legislation dealing with the protection of property. The imperative form of the law could be simple. You shall not steal. But when we come to the case law, well, again, there are complications. The civil law must concern itself with details. What about accidental damage through fire? What about when someone loses your property or damages it when they've borrowed it, or stealing by finding? Well, if you look through chapter 22, verse 1 and verse 6 to 15, you'll find that such cases are defined, the procedure involved, the compensation payable. We have the beginnings of the law on larceny and trespass and contract, but all derived, I suggest, from that fundamental moral rule, you shall not steal. So these civil statutes are translations of the moral law of God into a casuistic form. Civil law is as it is because the moral law is as it is. The legislation of Moses rests on a foundation of moral imperatives. The Ten Commandments, if you like, is the grid through which civil legislation finds its root. It wouldn't be difficult, in fact, to expound the whole of the Pentateuch, the whole of this huge body of law which God gave through Moses, as an exposition of the Ten Commandments. And many books have been written that interpret the law of God in the Old Testament in just that sort of way. Now, that's an absolutely vital insight. It's no exaggeration, I think, to say that once you accept that view of law, that it must have a moral foundation, that it alters the whole way you think about many vital issues about making and enforcing and keeping law today. Let me just identify for you three areas where I think this, you could call it old-fashioned way of looking at law, as something that must rest on a moral foundation, might change the way we respond to law in our day, national law, civil law. First of all, this moral foundation of law affects our attitude to legislation on so-called private vices. Secondly, this moral foundation to law affects our attitude to penal sanctions. And thirdly, this moral foundation to law affects our attitude to civil obedience. Those are the three things I want us to look at in detail this morning, taking our lead from different parts of the law of Moses. Let's start first with the attitude we have towards so-called private vices. I want to draw your attention to not a very pleasant little law. In chapter 22, verse 19. Moses says, anyone who has sexual relations with an animal must be put to death. Now, I say it's a rather unpleasant law, but it's of great interest because it's a law which is almost unthinkable could ever be placed on a statute book today. And the reason is because it has to do with people's private lives. The only possible grounds upon which such a law might be passed today is out of consideration for the rights of the animal concerned. See, one of the most obvious things that happens once you separate what is legal from any notion of morality is that advocates of a permissive or libertarian kind of mindset come in and say, well, that means the state has no right to try to legislate against vices which don't affect anybody else. To try to impose private morality by means of the civil courts is at best interfering paternalism and at worst repressive authoritarianism. It was John Stuart Mill in a famous essay entitled On Liberty who first gave expression, I think, to this view in the last century. He says, the sole end for which mankind are warranted individually or collectively in interfering with the liberty of action of any of their number is to prevent harm to others. He cannot rightfully be compelled to do or to forbear simply because in the opinion of others it would not be right. Private morality is a matter of individual conscience and it ought not to be made subject to legal sanctions. That's almost received doctrine today. A classic example, practically, of the way such an understanding of law affects things was back in the 50s and the Wolfenden Report. A report which said quite categorically, law is not to intervene in the private lives of citizens or to enforce any particular pattern of behaviour beyond what is necessary for the preservation of public order. And it was on the basis of that presupposition that the government decided that homosexual acts between consenting adults in private should no longer be a criminal offence. Very similar arguments are being used today about drug taking, pornography, voluntary euthanasia, and abortion. The fundamental plank for all the campaigners for the liberalisation of law in these kinds of areas is the right of private choice. Wherever the issue is one of private moral judgment, say jurists of this libertarian school, the law's job is to protect human freedom of choice, not to engage in patronising attempts at the protection of virtue. Well, I would suggest to you that Moses didn't agree with that. Anyone who has sexual relations with an animal must be put to death. It's just one example of the sort of law you find in the law of Moses. Bestiality was a sexual perversion well known in Canaan, but it fulfills all the criteria of our modern ideas of private morality. If a man wants to engage in such behaviour, offensive as it may seem to most of us, why should we interfere? The Constitution guarantees him the pursuit of happiness. Perhaps this makes him feel happy. So long as he doesn't make anybody else unhappy, what right have we to stop him? And the same may be said about criminal sanctions against other forms of sexual perversion. But God has no such scruples. If you look into the law of God more thoroughly, you'll find he makes homosexuality and incest and adultery as well as bestiality all criminal offences with severe penalties. For you see, the purpose of civil law, as the Bible understands it, is precisely to enforce moral standards, not just to protect the freedom of its citizens. This behaviour is wrong. God says so. And even those who have no reverence for God know it is wrong in their consciences. We don't have to prove the antisocial character of the offence. If it is wrong, and if a law can be passed against it, it ought to be. Now, of course, let me hasten to say, we know the civil law is limited in the extent to which it can practically enforce God's moral law by statute. Certain moral principles are unenforceable. You shall not covet, for instance. It would be difficult to prosecute a crime like that in the courts. Moses doesn't attempt to legislate against it. What's more, unless the majority of the general public are prepared to obey a piece of civil legislation, its enforcement becomes impracticable. Lying, for instance, except in the very specific case of perjury, can't really be legislated against. Moral failure of some kinds is so common as to make it ridiculous to pass laws against it. And the civil law of Moses recognizes this. It does not legislate hopeless causes. Sometimes, indeed, it compromises with the stricter standards of God's moral rule because, as Jesus put it, of the hardness of men's hearts. And the law on divorce seems a classic case of that. Nevertheless, as far as is practically possible, the civil law mirrors the moral law. And that includes this controversial area of so-called private vice. We simply have to be convinced of the immoral character of the offence, and then if enforceable legislation is practicable against it, we have a responsibility to see such legislation placed on the statute book. And that observation seems to me of enormous importance in this whole area of, for instance, abortion legislation, which we have to think through right now. That's the first implication, then, of seeing civil law as resting on a moral foundation. It means that there is no way people can shield off their private lives and say, what I do on my own isn't the business of the courts. It may very well be. It was in the days of Moses. Secondly, it affects our attitude towards penal sanctions, this moral foundation for law. Look at chapter 21, verse 23. If there is serious injury, you are to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. A verse that scandalizes many liberal 20th century people. And yet I suggest to you, it's an enormously important verse. See, there are three theories of punishment. One theory is that it should be reformatory. You punish the criminal to change him for the better. The second is that it should be a deterrent. You punish the criminal to deter others from following his bad example. The third is that it should be retributive. You punish the criminal because what he's done is wrong and deserves to be punished. Now, the followers of John Stuart Mill and that humanistic theory of law that has dominated the last century in our land inevitably opt for one or other of the first two of those alternatives. According to them, law is fundamentally social expediency. The criminal's behavior is antisocial. The only reason for punishing him is to try to protect society from injury. So the penalty must be socially oriented. Either it must aim to rehabilitate the criminal back in society with his antisocial tendencies removed, or else it must try to prevent other people in society from being threatened or infected with his sort of antisocial behaviour. But any idea of retribution, you see, is out. Why? Well, because to say you are punishing a man because he deserves to be punished is to imply a moral judgment on the action considered in isolation from its social consequences. It's to imply an intrinsic goodness or badness in the act. And that is what modern man no longer wants to believe in. Now, what do we find when we turn to the Bible? What sort of punishment is meted out in the law of Moses? Well, we do find the idea of reformatory punishment, but it's almost totally restricted to the family setting rather than the courts. And we do find the idea of deterrent, too. You'll sometimes find Moses saying, all Israel will hear and fear when they see what happens to this particular criminal. But that's quite a rare comment for him to make. There can be no doubt at all that the principal thrust in the Bible's theory of punishment is retributive, unpopular as that is today. Two facts deriving from our passage under consideration in Exodus make this plain. The first is the use of capital punishment. And of course, the followers of a humanistic approach about law universally disapprove of capital punishment. Firstly, because by definition it can't be reformatory. A dead criminal can't change for the better. And secondly, because they argue its effectiveness as a deterrent is questionable. And yet we read in the Law of Moses that for willful murder, witchcraft, kidnapping, sexual perversion, even filial rebelliousness, the penalty was death. Why did God order such a penalty of despair? Isn't it cruel and vindictive and uncivilized? What's the point of it? Well, the point is, you see, that civil law is not just social expediency. Paul tells us in the New Testament, but with a background greatly informed from what he understood of the Old Testament, that civil authorities are there to execute God's wrath on the wrongdoer. That's why they bear the sword. When God sends a man to hell, he doesn't do it to reform him, nor to deter others. He does it because the man is evil, and God's absolute moral character has been repelled by that evil. He deserves punishment, and he knows he deserves it. Hell is a retribution, not just a deterrent. Similarly, when God punishes a man through the agency of civil authorities who execute his authority on his behalf, the same principle holds. What the man did was wrong, fundamentally, absolutely morally wrong. He therefore deserves to be punished. The wrath of God is on him. People sometimes ask you what right the state has to take the life of a man away. Well, the answer is, the state has no right. The death penalty is God's prerogative. But he has mandated that awful authority to civil authorities in his wisdom, presumably because he knows it is necessary, because justice demands such a penalty in certain circumstances. Now, of course, it's perfectly true to say that Israel did not have the advantage, if we may call it an advantage, of prisons. And it may well be that prison sentences could replace the death penalty in many or even all of the capital offences listed in Exodus. Now, equally, it could be argued that depriving a man of liberty for life is in fact a far more dehumanising form of punishment than to hang him. But details like that aside, the fundamental character of punishment in these chapters is retributive. And the phenomenon of capital punishment proves that. As also does that famous verse that we just read in verses 23 and 25 of chapter 21. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Many people are outraged by that instruction, but you see, where it occurs in context, Moses is clearly discussing what the judges shall do in a case of injury as a result of violence. A particular case is a woman hurt in a brawl. And what he says is that the punishment must match the crime. This is simply retributive justice. Vengeance is not to be allowed free rein. The man is to be punished, but his punishment is to be assessed by the judges, who are not emotionally involved in the feud, and is to be strictly calculated in proportion to the injury received. He's to be punished according to what his crime deserves, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That feeling of proportionality can be clearly seen, too, in the clear distinction we find all through these chapters between the penalty administered to crimes of violence and the penalty for crimes against property. Nowhere do you find in the Law of Moses that a thief is to be punished by having his hand cut off or to be hung for stealing a sheep. Those sort of laws are often found in the world. Crimes of property are often regarded as more serious than crimes against the person. But not in the Law of Moses, because of its moral foundation. It's not just there to protect a certain property class or a certain economic way of life. It's there to do justice. No matter how much money a man had, if he hit somebody and in that hitting hurt him permanently, that man paid a price, however much money he had. Crimes of property are punished by taking property away. The miscreant is forced to pay financial compensation, not to the state, you notice, but to the person that he robbed from. Now, there is no question that people who kill or are violent should be punished in that way. Now, the morality of the situation dictates that these crimes of violence are of a different order from crimes against property, and retributive punishment must reflect that. You see, what happens, in fact, when society rejects this idea of punishing according to desert, moral desert? What happens is that justice goes out of the window. Nobody's expressed this more eloquently than C.S. Lewis in an essay some years ago. Let me read you a bit of it. The fact is, he says, you cannot talk about a just deterrent or a just cure. We demand of a deterrent not whether it is just, but whether it will deter. We demand of a cure not whether it is just, but whether it succeeds. Thus, when we cease to consider what a criminal deserves and consider only what will cure him or deter others, we have tacitly removed him from the sphere of justice altogether. Instead of a responsible person endowed with rights, we now have a mere patient, a case. It will be in vain to protest his punishment is disproportionate to the crime, for the experts with perfect logic will reply, no one is talking about punishment. Here are the statistics to prove that the treatment we are giving this man deters. Here are the statistics to prove that the treatment we are giving this man cures. See what he's saying? Once we cease to think in terms of morality, law starts thinking instead in terms of sociology. To punish a man is to preserve his dignity as a responsible human being. To say, oh, you couldn't help it, we'll make you better, is to open the door to all kinds of inhuman and degrading manipulation of that personality in the name of curing him. To say, oh, we must make a special example of you to deter others, is to repeat the verdict of Caiaphas. It's expedient that one man die for the sake of the nation. I suggest to you that reformatory and deterrent theories of punishment can be far more vicious than this biblical principle of punishment in proportion to desert. To see civil law not just as men shaping society as they want it to be, but as an enforcement of justice. I'm not advocating that we take a leaf out of Khomeini's Iran and start introducing mutilation into our penal code. But we have got to rethink the way we punish criminals. And very rapidly. And that issue of justice lies very much at the heart of the third thing I want to mention to you that flows out of this whole question of morality as the basis of legality. I suggest to you that when we see things that way, it changes our attitude also to responsible civil obedience. Just look at chapter 23, verses 6 to 9. Do not deny justice to your poor people in their lawsuits. Have nothing to do with a false charge, and do not put an innocent or honest person to death, for I will not acquit the guilty. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds those who see and twists the words of the righteous. Now, it's clear from the format that here we have a moral law. It's apodictic in style, imperative. The interesting thing about these particular moral laws is that unlike the others, they are not directed at the man in the street. They are directed at the civil authorities themselves. And that's a crucial observation. Moses is in those verses telling the judges the moral principles of justice and impartiality and fair play, which must enforce their civil administration. You're not a law to yourself, he's saying to them. You yourselves are accountable to a higher law. I will not acquit the guilty. It's the law of God you're administering. There is a moral constraint upon you judges. You are yourselves responsible for the kind of verdicts that you bring in. They must be just verdicts. Now that I regard as a critical observation. You see, law and order is being brought into contempt in our society today. It was Mr. Bumble in Dickens' Oliver Twist, wasn't it, who first made the famous observation that the law is an ass, an idiot. And that's a verdict that's been echoed many times down the years, not just from husbands like Bumble, who are exasperated by judicial naivety about the realities of marriage. We are living in a world today in which more and more members of society seem not just to be saying that the law is an ass, but expressing their disdain of law by flagrantly ignoring its direction. We have pop stars who are arrested on drugs offences and affirm their scornful impenitence in Sunday newspapers. We have trade unions defying court injunctions and treating fines for contempt as a badge of honour. We have peace movements and and animal rights campaigners and Save the Whale protesters and goodness knows who else, all engaging in civil disobedience in order to further their goals and insisting that right is on their side. And of course we have terrorism. Groups of men and women, despairing of justice ever being given to them by legal means, resorting to violence and blackmail, and being rewarded for their pains by unparalleled media attention to their case. The Apostle Paul said in his second letter to the Thessalonians that rebelliousness would be a characteristic of the last days. He even speaks of a spirit of anarchy infiltrating the world order, and one could be excused for concluding his prophecy is coming true in our century. And yet, of course, no one can deny, can they, that the force of law can be abused. Many times in the last few hundred years, good men have had to refuse to accept the dictates of those who were the law and order of their land. And we admire them for it. Thinks of Thomas More in his famous debate with Henry VIII. He said it was beyond the power of English Parliament to make the king the head of the church. Now we may not agree with the Catholic theology that informed More's views on that. I think most of us would feel that his protest was legitimate. He was more worthy to be canonized as a saint than executed as a traitor. Or take a more recent example. What about Hitler's barbarous laws against the Jews in Nazi Germany? Radbruch, a notable German lawyer, insisted those laws were illegal. They couldn't be passed. He encouraged the courts to refuse to accept any defense based on such inhuman statutes. Nazi law, he said, was not just an ass, it was a devil, and it had to be defied. Again, most of us would feel his style of anarchy was justified. To give an example which is right up to date, what about the apartheid laws in South Africa? How should people respond to them? How does one draw this line? We have a prime minister who has made much in her election manifesto of the need for law and order. But how far can law and order go before it becomes a mere euphemism for tyranny and oppression? That's a vital question for us to ask. One major reason there is so much widespread contempt for law today is that people no longer perceive law to rest on a moral foundation. And in fact, parliaments have colluded in this by passing more and more laws which have far more to do with the government's ambition to control people than any clear and obvious concern to establish justice in the land. When people feel the courts are being used as tools of policy rather than as organs of justice, their respect for civil authority and the very cogency of the law itself is drastically eroded. Civil government can only be strong when people are convinced in their hearts that the raison d'etre of that governmental authority is to enforce justice. But that government exists with a sense of accountability to that higher law, that natural law, that moral law. And only because that sense of moral accountability is clearly evident can Moses also say in his law in chapter 22, verse 28, "Don't blaspheme God or curse the ruler of your people." Those two things stand together, chapter 22, verse 28, and chapter 23, verse 6. They balance one another. It's vital that we understand that today. Of course, the normal Christian attitude towards civil authorities must be one of submission and obedience. Do not curse the ruler of your people. Paul endorses that in the New Testament. He tells us that the governments that be are an institution of God and we must obey them. Christian can't endorse the tactic of those who treat the law with contempt. If he saw the civil law merely as a social convention, perhaps he could. But because he sees it as a reflection of God's moral authority, that is out of the question. Obedience to the rule of law becomes for the Christian, as Paul calls it in Romans 13, a matter of conscience. And yet we have to say that that very same conviction about the moral nature of civil authority means that the obedience a Christian offers the state can never be unconditional. For it is God's law the state is mandated to enforce, not man's. So Moses says in verse 1 of chapter 23, do not help a wicked man by being a malicious witness. And that applies even if the wicked man in question happens to be the king. And he's inciting you to be a malicious witness. He says in verse 2, do not follow the crowd in doing wrong. And that remains true even if the crowd happens to have secured a majority at the ballot box, doesn't it? He says in verse 7, have nothing to do with a false charge and do not put an innocent or honest person to death. And that applies, doesn't it? Even if the instruction to put that innocent person to death happens to come from your commanding officer. The moral law, you see, directed to the individual conscience, means that we are not subject to the arbitrary dictates of the government of our day. The civil law is only valid law when it reflects a concern for justice, when it is informed by moral principle. And it seems to me God has left open the door of the possibility that sometimes moral obedience to the higher law may require civil disobedience to governmental law. Governments can't create laws in defiance of God's standards of justice. If they try to, then the same Christian conscience which would normally constrain submission may constrain rebellion against them. To put it another way, what is legal and what is moral may diverge if governments are foolish enough to tread that path. But if they do, the law will be brought into disrepute and governments will be inviting social unrest. And Christians may feel conscience-bound to be part of that unrest, or else be judged as conspirators in that judicial corruption. See what I mean then when I say that this idea of a moral foundation to law affects very drastically the way you respond to civil legislation. What we have in Exodus 21 and 22 and 23 is a God-centered civil legislation. Legislation that recognizes that its mandate doesn't derive from the democratic consensus of the people or the philosophical opinions of some human jurist or even the collective wisdom of custom and tradition or the coercion of the monarch. What we have here is the jurisprudence of God, a legal system based not on custom or theory or popular will or monarchical power, but on moral law, divine authority. And that is something which the last 100 years of our history have stolen from us in the West, and something which it seems to me as Christians we ought to be campaigning to restore. Remember Jesus' words, you are the salt of the earth. You're the light of the world. I haven't come to abolish law, he says. It's part of your role in my kingdom to teach people this law. And if we're going to do that, then it will mean campaigning for laws against private vice. It will mean campaigning for penal reform. The prisons of our land are packed to overflowing. It's a major problem. We have a major opportunity to argue for a retributive model of our penal system. And it means campaigning for civil responsibility. Responsibility that urges citizens to respect the force of law because they have a moral obligation to do so. But a responsibility that also urges governments to limit their enthusiasm for passing statutes to those that are clearly related to natural justice because they have a moral obligation to do so. And when we find people responding to our protests and our campaigning, where does this moral obligation you keep talking about derive from? Surely morality is just a social convention, just a matter of individual conscience. We shall reply to them, no. God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall. That's where the moral law comes from. The mouth of God. He wrote it on our consciences when he made us in his image. He wrote it down for us on tablets of stone that we may be sure that those moral laws, that natural law that we intuitively are aware of as human beings, is not mere subjective feeling or tradition. It is inherent in the mind and the will of the truth behind the universe. It's an absolute, permanent, universal law, and its authority is not to be shaken. Do you see what God says in verse 6 of the Ten Commandments? I am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to thousands who love me and keep my commandments. The greatest gift we can give to our land, if we're concerned for its prosperity, is the law of God. Let's pray together.